favorite stories from Judaism, which is the tradition of my childhood, is about a wise old man who is seen planting fig trees out in the deep heat of a desert afternoon. People walking by see this respected man bent with age, working to get these young saplings in the ground. They ask him, "Why are you planting these trees? Truly you, a man of great age and wisdom, do not expect to live long enough to reap a harvest. It will take many, many years for these trees to bear fruit." The old man answers, "I am not planting them for me, but for the generations to come." The wise man knew that his actions would and should have an effect far into the future. This concept is also found in the Hopi tradition, in which they envision how their actions will affect people 7 generations down the line. We too need to recognize and take our place in the river of time. We need to plant for the future, to plant fig trees that will bear fruit that others will harvest. But what is it that we need to plant? And what is our soil like? What is the climate that we're working with? Barbara Marks Hubbard, who's a futurist out in California, puts it out in an easy to digest form when she talks about conscious evolution. She examines our solar system and the creation of Earth about 4 billion years ago and the life cycle of the Sun, which will expand, swallowing the orbits of all the inner planets of the solar system, including the Earth, in about another 2.5 billion years. So she therefore locates us about halfway through the life cycle of a planet that's orbiting an average star. So that is to say that we are right now in the middle of our planetary life. And right now, I would say that we're going through a midlife crisis. Now, our midlife crisis is more involved than finally buying a sports car or deciding to get a tattoo. But still, it is a kind of identity crisis. And during this time, we are all called to examine how we define ourselves and our place on the globe and in the cosmos. So this morning, I'd like to remind us all of 2 things. The first is that a midlife crisis is completely natural. And the second is that it is very, very serious. In our case, in the midlife crisis of the Earth, there are multiple non-linear intersecting crises that ultimately will determine our fate on this planet. You see, humans have finally become powerful enough and technologically savvy enough to actually destroy ourselves. And that means we really need to come up with alternatives different than those we now present to ourselves, which seems to be a pick-your-poison mode of self-destruction. The Earth's midlife crisis involves the air we breathe and the trees which provide it. It involves the water we drink and the land we live on. The crisis involves the food that we need, the whims of the weather that we affect, the waste we create, our battles over the resources that we can't seem to share. The crisis involves population growth, globalization, and also a dawning world community with a growing gulf between the rich and the poor. And what's more, all of these intersecting crises are going to come to a head in my lifetime. As the people of my generation come of age, we are going to have to work our way through the midlife crisis of the Earth as we enter our own midlife. When the people in your youth group take on the mantle of leadership, when they are senators and CEOs, teachers and principals and superintendents, when they are the directors of nonprofits and service agencies, the year will be 2042. Ultimately, in the course of our life, we will have to decide the fate of our woodlands, the fate of our creatures, the fate of our skies and lakes and neighbors. We are the generation of choice. the generation that will make the decisions that will determine if we can live sustainably on this planet, or if we will slowly poison our earth, seas, and skies. Now, the generation of choice isn't alone in this battle. We stand on the shoulders of those who have come before. We bear the fruit of all the social action that has come before, of all the freedoms fought for, the freedom to speak our mind, the freedoms of religion and worship that have been fought for by our spiritual forebears in Europe and the colonies. Unitarians and Universalists have been on the forefront of these movements from their inception, and from our roots in the Radical Reformation and the martyrdom of people like Michael Servetus, to the work of Joseph Tuckerman, who's recognized as the founder of social work here in the United States. The generation of choice bears the fruit of all the movements that were born in the 60s liberation and consciousness raising movements. Movements that brought to our attention the destruction of our planet and the cycles of oppression. But ironically, these very people who could benefit so much from the collective wisdom of our movement are missing from our congregations. In many UU churches, on most Sundays, young adults are the least visible group in that church. Often, the UU church is absent from the lives of young adults during their formative college, career building, and future determining years. So part of my ministry, part of the work I am called to do, is to bring young families and young adults back into our congregations, to co-create communities that have meaning for them, to let ourselves evolve and adapt to new ways of being and new forms of worship. I am called to find ways to help people to find space in their lives for those things that can only be found in a church community. And I hope that you here gathered can walk with me for a while on that path, the journey which ultimately will lead to the future of this movement. In the New Hampshire and Vermont district, we have started to do the hard work of planting fig trees. We've begun to reach out to the generation of choice. We have started 5 campus ministries in the district, and this church today is being led in worship by some of your own young adults, many of whom are homegrown. Now is the time for our movement as a whole and for each congregation to till the soil and to think about our future not in the immediate sense, but in terms of the generations to come. Will there be a place for our great, 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 great grandchildren? Will it be above ground? We can't imagine because the future is so uncertain. It's uncertain because of the multiple crises that we face, and it's uncertain because it's impossible to imagine that far into the future. Impossible to imagine because of the rapid rate of expansion and growth. Impossible to imagine because of the exponential acceleration of information and change in the world. Think of the changes in the last 50 years. And if you're old enough, think for a moment about the year 1955. I know from talking with my Nana that our world, as we lived, was inconceivable back then. And I can't help but get the idea when I talk with her, this sense of sort of bitterness and desperation. And she feels as if someone came along and changed the rules on her midstream in the middle of her life. For us, 50 years into the future is unfathomable because the rates of transformation continue to speed up. I'm going to talk math for just a moment. There's a unit of measure which is sort of the sum total of all the information in the world. And what social scientists have done is they've taken the time from sort of the dawn of humanity until the Renaissance as one unit of measurement, or actually to the Roman Empire. And they've called that one unit, and they said all the information that you could learn from that that moment to there. They totaled that and gave it a figure, and then they started to figure the amount of information. What they're finding is the rate of information is doubling exponentially quicker. So if you take all the information between the dawn of man to the Roman Empire, and then the Roman Empire to the Renaissance, that information doubled. And then from the Renaissance to the French Revolution, it doubled again. And so it's this exponential growth that's happening faster and faster. So right now, the estimates are that information is doubling every 6 months. And so so it continues to move exponentially faster. So if you follow this math, we won't, in the 21st century, we won't experience 50 or 100 years of progress. It will be more like 20,000 years of progress from the past. And so just to give you an illustration of exponential growth, I'll tell a story that's about the inventor of chess and his patron, who's the Emperor of China. In response to the emperor's offer for a reward for this new game, the inventor asked for a single grain of rice to be doubled on a chessboard, every square. So the first square would have one grain of rice, the second square would have two, then four, then eight. So the emperor quickly granted what was a seemingly benign request. So one version of the story has the emperor going bankrupt as the 63 doublings ultimately totaled 18 million trillion grains of rice, which would require rice fields covering twice the surface area of the earth, including the oceans. Another version of the story, and one that may be more believable, has the inventor quickly losing his head. But as the emperor and the inventor went through the first half of the chessboard, things were fairly uneventful. The inventor was given spoonfuls of rice, then bowls of rice, then barrels. But by the end of the first half of the chessboard, the inventor had accumulated one large field's worth, which is about 4 million grains of rice. And at that point, the emperor did start to take notice. But it was as they progressed through the second half of the chessboard that things really began to deteriorate. Now, if you remember our midlife crisis, I would say that we're at about the halfway point of the chessboard, and we've begun to take notice, and things are starting to get ready to deteriorate. Thinkers like Terence McKenna, using the mathematics of fractals, has calculated that the rate of information and change, as we've been talking about, will double many times a second by the year 2012, which is just inconceivable to think about. But I find that idea exciting and hopeful because of the limitless opportunities that we'll have to evolve and get past this midlife crisis that we're living through. Now, I don't hold his theories as a mathematical certainty, even though the math is correct. But I think of it as a metaphor for the contractions of a society birthing a new world. And for that birth to be successful, we need midwives. And those midwives will come from the generation of choice. For this birth, we need prophets and truth tellers who can see the harm that we are causing ourselves. And we also need visionaries who can see a world that has averted the disasters that are bearing down on us. We need visionaries who can see a better world and can imagine backwards in time and figure out how we got there. And again, this is where Unitarian Universalists come in, because we nurture and develop visionaries in our churches and in our RE programs. We just need to make a place for them to stay here. We know how to do social movements. We know how to speak truth to power. More importantly, though, we know how to listen. Our gift to the world is the way we function. Our gift is our congregational polity, which allows a decentralized denomination to still work effectively. We offer an example of how organizations can work together to make decisions. We demonstrate a place where, at our best, every voice is honored, yet no voice is allowed to hold the whole captive to their opinion. We are a church that holds town meetings in an effort to make decisions as a community. We are an institution that holds dialogue with the goal of understanding each other. And that is a good gift. Our principles define what it means to be in right relationship with each other and with our world. And the effort to live by those principles is what we can share with the people coming of age right now. Our gift is our Sangha, the community of fellow seekers working towards similar goals in a multitude of ways. Our gift is the congregation itself, communities that can be truly multi-generational, where wisdom and energy and ideas can be exchanged. Our gift is our churches, human relations labs that allow us to love the questions and work toward living our ways into the answers. Our gift is sanctuary, where we each can touch the deep truth within us and commit ourselves, as we have just done, to living our values in the world, doing the great work of Tikkun Olam, which means healing our world. There are many reasons we need to open our community, our communities, and welcome youth and young adults here. We could talk about growing our churches. We could make arguments for the importance of this demographic to the growth of our denomination. We could even make arguments based on the important service that church life provides to those people in a hostile and alienated world. We could talk about the infusion of idealism and energy that the generation of choice will bring here to this church. Today, though, I want to hold something else up. The generation of choice will determine the future course of this planet, and that future hangs in the balance. We have a lot to share with them. Our community and our denomination needs to recognize and take our place in the river of time. Now begins the hard work of minding the future. Now we plant fig trees that future generations will harvest. May it be so.